I wonder, as people look at your life, hear you speak, see the way you work, see your response to temptation, see your response to trials, see how you deal with difficulty and crushed expectations, what would your life and your actions and your words reveal about the God you say you worship? What would people think? What conclusions would they draw about your faith? Chapter 26 clearly reveals David's faith, where his confidence is, where his trust is. And it's a faith that has grown through his experiences. In part, his actions in chapter 26 are formed from what has happened in chapters 24 and chapters 25. And it's worth saying that chapter 24 and chapter 26 are two passages that closely parallel each other. So in both, David has an opportunity to kill Saul. In both, his men urge him to do so in almost exactly the same words. In both, David refused. In both, David took a token from Saul, which later served as proof of David's loyalty. In both, David refused to flee, but chose to confront Saul. In both, Saul repented after a certain manner. Both use similar phrases. And yet there are distinct differences in how the situations came about and in how David responds. But what is notable, especially when you include chapter 25, is in somewhat the progression in how David's faith grows, how his faith is evident, how his faith is grown as he's faced with a difficult and tempting situation. I wonder how you would respond. How you would respond to a difficult, tempting situation. What would your faith reveal? David is an example to us. Firstly, he is a faith that obeys, verses 1 to 11. It's a faith that obeys. See, verses 1 to 5 set the scene for us. The Ziphites have once again betrayed David. They've reported to Saul where David is hiding, verse 1, in the hills of Hakilah. And so Saul, verse 2, moves his 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search there for David. Saul makes a camp. David learns of this, sends out spies to confirm his presence. David then decides to go and check out the camp for himself. And we're not told why David goes. Perhaps it was just purely to kind of gather additional information about the one who threatened him, about the size of the army. He just wanted to see for himself what he faced. And his covert efforts were rewarded. He was able to see clearly 3,000 men. He was able to see the exact location, the exact arrangement of the camp. And once there, he spies an opportunity. As he spots Saul lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him, verse 5. So he asked, verse 6, Elimelech and Abishai, who will go down into the camp with me to Saul? And Abishai immediately says, yes, I'll go with you. And so, verse 7, David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and his soldiers were lying around him. Abner's the bodyguard. The soldiers lying around Saul are the elite forces, the best of the best. And David and Abishai had managed to creep right up to King Saul past them all. And Abishai sees the opportunity to kill Saul. Today, David, God has given your enemy into your hands. Now, let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice. Now, I don't think that David's intention in coming to the camp was to kill Saul. Chapter 24, verse 6, is already revealed that he was forbidden to kill God's anointed. We learned last week in chapter 25 that personal revenge is not a good thing. You just got to leave it to God. So I don't think he came to kill Saul. And of course, his words in verse 9 are fairly emphatic. Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? But can you imagine the temptation that David must have felt? There is David in the camp. He's crept past 3,000 men, all armed, all with orders to kill him. He's right there. Abner, Saul's bodyguard, has not stirred, nor has any of the elite men around Saul. And David is there, and Abishai is there with a spear in his hand. And you can imagine it, can't you? Just hovering over Saul's heart, waiting for David to go, do it. And one thrust, and David's problems are removed. The kingdom would be his. There would be no more running, no more hiding in caves. It's all over. But David says, no. Why? Because of his faith in God. See, his faith that God will handle Saul. His faith that God will avenge Saul, just as God had avenged Nabal. See verse 10? As surely as the Lord lives, the Lord himself will strike him. And the verb there, strike, is the same verb that's used in chapter 25, verse 38, when the Lord struck down Nabal. See, David has learned the Lord can be trusted to handle both fools and oppressors when such matters are left in his hands. See, verse 10, the Lord may be pleased to dispose of Saul as he did Nabal. Or then again, he may not. The Lord may work by some other method. He may permit Saul a natural death, or he might see that Saul is swept away in battle. There are kind of numerous possibilities that David can imagine. And that's okay, because he's imagining them in faith. He's not sitting there going, imagining how he could kill Saul and seek to do it himself. He's not kind of doing the personal revenge thing. You know what it's like after an argument and you rerun it, or you get into a fight and you think about how you wish you were a black belt in karate and you could really kick them and hurt them. Maybe that's just me. Okay, you guys are just making me feel bad. But there he is, and he's not imagining in that way. He's imagining how the Lord may so work out his purposes for Saul. He's imagining in faith. Some of us need to do that. When we're faced in a situation, in faith, think how the Lord may possibly handle this situation. And as we kind of imagine in faith those things, it kind of builds our faith and gives us confidence to say, do you know what? I'm going to trust in God. See, David's faith is rooted in God. It's rooted in God's purposes. It's rooted in God's character. And faith that is rooted in God will always lead to obedience. Will always lead to obedience, even when we cannot see the end picture. Even when I can't quite see. David couldn't quite see how the end would be for Saul. Oh, he could imagine in faith, but he couldn't quite see it. But he has his faith in God that will always lead to obedience. See verse 11, the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. And think about it, Abishai's argument. It sounded theologically plausible, didn't it? I mean, it sounded God-centered. I mean, David has just crept through 3,000 men. No one is stirring. They've got a spear above Saul's heart. And Abishai looks at him and says, you know, God has given your enemy into your hand. Here's your God-given chance. Surely God would want you to take it. And of course, on one level, it would have been the easy way out for David. But you see, faith is able to see that which is of God and that which is not. See, at that point, with Abishai's words in his ears, is at that point, faith says, I will obey God. I will trust his purposes, even though I cannot see the end. I will not take things into my own hand. I will do that which is commanded and clear. And some will say, but how? How do we know what is of God and what is not of God? Because we seek to obey that which is commanded. David is forbidden to kill God's anointed. Therefore, Abishai's words cannot be right. And faith leads me to therefore obey. And such faith is grown through experience, chapter 25. It's spirit-given. It grows as we call out to God. It grows as we spend time with God so that we know God's purposes. David knew what he must do. And that faith enabled him to say no to Abishai and obey God. Now, I'm not David, and nor are you. We're not God's anointed. But David's experience, his predicament, it's true for all believers, isn't it? Any believer will face predicaments in which they do not know how God will bring about relief. They cannot see the end result, as it were. But we do know what is or is not God's wills or purposes for us. So, for example, a Christian cannot guess how Christ will bring resolution to a marital problem. But one does know that, for instance, they must not commit adultery. One does know they don't have the choice of just bailing as soon as things get tough. And you can guarantee in such a situation there will be temptation. There will be those like Abishai whispering other things, saying, surely God wants you to be happy. And you can't be happy if you remain with him or her. And it sounds theologically plausible at that point. I mean, God wants me to be happy, doesn't he? And at that point, it's faith that says, I will obey God. I'll trust his purposes. I'll trust his commands that say, do not commit adultery, do not flee. I'll trust him to handle this. Even though I cannot see the end, I cannot see how it might work out. I can imagine in faith. But by faith I'll obey. And I'll do so knowing his grace to help and to sustain and to grant us faith to trust his purposes and his providence. And of course it's not hard to think of other predicaments, is it? Situations at work or at home as we face trials and we'll hear the theologically plausible sounding arguments. And at that point, it's faith in God, in his clear commands, in his purposes, that leads me to obey God. Just like it led Jesus to. Do you remember Mark chapter 8, verse 32, where Jesus has just told his disciples he has to die and rise again? And what happens? Peter rebukes him. Kind of an Abishai moment. You can imagine what Peter said to Jesus. Jesus, this isn't of God. God wouldn't want the Messiah or his chosen one, his son, to die. It can't be right. And of course, it sounds theologically plausible, doesn't it? Would God really want his son to die? And Jesus' response is what? Get behind me, Satan. Because Jesus' faith is in the purpose of God. He knows what he must do. He knows what is commanded and is clear. And he knows it is good and it is right. And he willingly obeys. Faith in God will always lead me to obey God. Trusting in his purposes will always lead me to obey God, just like it did David, even in the midst of serious, real temptation. A faith that obeys, verses 1 to 11. But secondly, we see a faith that is encouraged, verse 12 to 16. Faith that is encouraged. See, having stopped Abishai from killing Saul, David then takes Saul's spear and water jug and leaves, verse 12. And no one saw, no one knew about it, no one woke, because the Lord, verse 12, had put them into a deep sleep. And there's a significance in what David has taken. The spear is the sign of the king's authority. Do you remember Genesis 49, verse 10? That one from Judah would come with a scepter, a spear. Here is the one from Judah with the scepter in his hand. David has the symbol of kingly authority. And he has the jug, and the jug symbolizes life. Hunting in a desert requires water. You need your canteen. So here is David now with the authority of the king in one hand and the king's life, as it were, in the other hand. And with these two powerful symbols in his hand, David awakes Abner, awaken him from the deep God-induced sleep that he's been in. Aren't you going to answer, Abner? And Abner staggers and begins to come round and to collect his wits. And whilst he does, David continues with the jibes. And David's words are simple. You're a man, aren't you? Who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord the king? Someone came to destroy your lord the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. He's making it clear, isn't he? Abner, this premier career man, has proven to be a shoddy bodyguard. Indeed, all of them have. In fact, David says a whole lot of them are sons of death. That is, all Saul's men should be court-martialed and executed for failing to protect the life of the king. Can you imagine Abner hearing those words? And he thinks probably at this point, ah, David, you're joking. Until David says at the end of verse 16, look where the king's spear and water jug are. They're there with David. For all Saul's protection, sleeping in the centre of 3,000 men and Abner nearby, Saul is defenceless. The symbol of his power has been effortlessly taken. David has disarmed Saul, and it's a clear parable of what is to come. Saul's power is gone. Nothing can keep David from attaining the kingdom. God's king will be anointed. Saul can hunt David down, seek all he wants to destroy him, but David will be king. The power will be transferred. It's a clear sign to Saul and his men, but also to David. And what an encouragement to David. He knows what the Lord has done. He knows that the Lord has allowed him to enter the camp, to gain the spear. And he knows what it means. As he stands there with the spear, he knows he will be king. That Saul will not win in spite of 3,000 men seeking to hunt him down. Isn't that the kind of God God is? That he's a God who encourages in the midst of difficulty. David is in the midst of it. And David's eyes are lifted to the God who is in charge. This simple act of holding the spear, of being allowed to enter the camp and no one serve, strengthened David's faith. Psalm 18 records his emotion. He declared, David says in Psalm 18, I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer. My God is my rock in whom I take refuge. See, David has a faith in a God who encourages at our time of need. David has a faith in a God who encourages at our time of need. That simple act of holding the spear and holding the jug are just a parable, a sign of what is to come. He's a God who encourages. John Flavel, a Puritan preacher in the 1600s, tells the true story of a certain Mrs. Honeywood, an earnest Christian who nevertheless felt God had cast her off and that she was without saving hope. One day a minister was meeting with her and chatting with her and giving her reasons against her desperate conclusions. It was then that she took a Venice glass from the table and said, Sir, I am sure to be damned as this glass is to be broken. And with that she threw it mightily to the ground. To the astonishment of both, the glass remained intact and unbroken. And obviously the minister did not fail to apply the assuring sign. Does not God encourage our hearts at our time of need? Does he not grant us signs that lift our eyes? Does he not do that by reminding us that the one David foreshadowed holds the spear, holds our life in his hand? That his cross, his resurrection, that's which we are going to remember shortly, shout loudly, he is king, his kingdom is coming. It is like David holding the spear, the kingdom's not yet come, but he is ruling. And Jesus will restore and renew and make things as they should be. And on those days when we're in the midst of it, on those days when we cannot see a way out, on those days when I feel wretched, when I feel like I'm barely clinging on and all I can do is maintain just to cling on with my fingernails, as it were, on days like that, but to lift our eyes to the one who holds the spear, who holds our life in his hand, and know his kingdom is coming. That is ruling. That one day there will be no more pain and no more suffering. Does God not encourage our hearts? But are we like David to have the faith to see it? I wonder whether Abner was encouraged by this event. Maybe not right at the moment that he saw David with the spear. But after Saul died, we're told in 2 Samuel 3 that Abner, instead of continuing to fight for Saul's family, follows David. And I just wonder whether Abner recalled this day, that day he saw David with the spear, the day the future king spared his life. He deserved to die, but David did not kill him. I just wonder whether seeing David was the start of a journey to following, as it were, God's true anointed one. Maybe you're like Abner this morning. You kind of caught a glimpse of who the true king is. Maybe you've seen he holds your life in your hand. Maybe you've seen you deserve to die for your rejection and disobedience of the Creator. Maybe you see you're following the wrong king. Can I urge you, like Abner, to swap sides? Start following the true king. The one who truly holds the spear and holds life in his hand. Who are you following? Abner knew when to change sides, do you? Faith that is encouraged. Thirdly, a faith that trusts. A faith that trusts. Verses 17 to 25. See, Saul's stomach must have lurched when he recognized David's voice in the dark. It wasn't a dream. David really was there. It really was David. And David had his spear and water jug. And recovering his wits, Saul kind of gives David the my son treatment. But David will have none of it. Instead, he outlines the injustice of what is happening. Why is my Lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? What wrong am I guilty of? And as David sees it, there are two choices. Verse 19, if the Lord has incited you against me, then may he accept an offering. May I appease him. But if, however, men have done it, as it is more likely, that Saul has been egged on by vicious advisers or personal envy, may they be cursed before the Lord. Cursed because their actions have serious repercussions. Because they have pushed David to the point of leaving the land of Israel, driven him from his share in the Lord's inheritance, effectively pushing him towards serving other gods. Now, of course, David knew, because the Psalms tell us, that he could call on and speak to the God of Israel in any land. But he also knew that to be cut off from God's inheritance was to be cut off from God's face. When one had left Israel, there was no possibility of public worship. He couldn't attend the tent of meeting, the sanctuary, the place God had ordained for sacrifices to be made, the place God's presence dwelt amongst his people. David was being cut off from the tabernacle and sacrifice, from the priests and festivals. He was being shut out of the land and the sanctuary where God met with his people. See, what Saul was doing was serious. It was a total injustice with serious repercussions. And David is being treated with utter injustice, like a flea, a partridge hunted in the mountains. But note where David places his trust. Saul tries to woo him back. "Come back to me, David, my son," verse 21. "I have sinned, I've acted like a fool and erred greatly." But David will have none of it. Oh, he sees through Saul's words. He's heard it all before. No, David just entrusts himself firmly in the Lord, not in Saul's words. See, verse 23, "The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord gave you into my hands, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all in trouble." In the midst of injustice, in the midst of trouble, where else is there to place one's trust but to entrust oneself to the Lord and to his ways, and trusting that the Lord will reward, will undo all injustice? Oh, the contrast with Saul is all apparent. He's a foolish man, a man who failed to trust God, who did not obey God's commands, a man who did not have any problems with seeking to kill God's anointed, a man who took justice and vengeance into his own hands. Think of the poor priests of Nob. He could not be further than a man whose faith is trusting in God. Saul is a man who is rash and foolish, and who is living with foolish choices, and who is living with the consequences of not trusting God. David, though, is a man whose faith is firmly in God, and in his actions foreshadow that of Christ. When Christ is treated unjustly and wrongly, crucified, even though he had done nothing wrong, Peter records in 1 Peter 2:23 that Jesus entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Jesus entrusted himself, just like David, to the one who rewards and vindicates. Now again, we're not God's anointed. But Jesus says that those who follow him will be treated unjustly and wrongly. And when that happens, our response is to be like that of Christ, like that of David. We respond by entrusting ourselves to the Lord, to his justice, to him to deliver us from all trouble. Romans 12:9 makes that point, doesn't it? We're not to take personal vengeance. Rather, we're to leave it to the God of justice, entrusting ourselves to him. And yet how easy it is to become like Saul then David, to try and take things into our own hands, to do things our way, to seek vengeance, to pay back harm done to us, perceived or real, rather than entrust ourselves to God and his purposes, rather than follow the example of our Lord. David's faith mirrors that of Jesus. He's obedient. It's a faith that is encouraged and expectant. It's a faith that trusts in the purposes and justice of God. As people look at your life and hear you speak and see the way you work and see your response to temptation and see your response to trials and see how you deal with difficulty and crush expectation, what would your life, your actions, your words reveal about the God you say you worship? What would people think? What conclusions would they draw about your faith? Would they see someone with a faith that obeys, a faith that is encouraged, a faith that trusts?